3. Under a gray sky, Pierre of Altorskar left Esnar on December 19, 1827. Under a gray sky, the family carriage lumbered southward over the roads of the Western Marches, and as it passed through the village of Vermare, high in the foothills, the gray sky descended softly all at once, in flakes, heavy, thick, silent, filling all the air, whitening the fat rumps of the horses, the fur cap of the driver, hiding the way ahead. With a great push, Pierre got the window down so that she could put out her hand and feel the cold touch of winter.
"Oh, my dear, we'll catch our death. Oh, do put up the window. Do put on your gloves," cried Cousin Betta Berichoy,
who had gone all the way to Esnar in the carriage alone to fetch Pierre back, since Count Orland had come down with a very bad bronchitis a week before he was to set off for her and spend Christmas at the Belinens. But Cousin Betta was only too glad to go. Indeed, she was. The idea of that poor child coming all the way alone in the carriage like a pea in a gourd, even if old Godin was as trusty as could be. At any rate, Cousin Betta was so upset that Pierre raised the window again, only murmuring, "It never snows in Esnar."
"Oh, I believe it does. Indeed it does, I'm sure. I suppose the warm fountain quite melts it. Wouldn't that be odd? Does it? Oh, dear me, how very thick it's coming. If we should be snowed in up in the passes, far from any house."
Cousin Betta's eyes shone. From time to time, romances, stronger fare than the new Eloise, had been finding their way up to Portocheca, and Cousin Betta read them, and though the possibility of getting snowbound on the mountain road was neither remote nor pleasant, the phrase, "far from any house," sounded so like a novel that it thrilled her. Pierre merely said, "The wind mostly keeps the Portocheca pass clear." Cousin Betta had discovered already that Pierre had become a strong-minded young woman at the convent. She was always calm, and doubtless never read romances. The snow made little trouble for their horses. It melted as soon as it touched earth after its fall through the soft, windless air. Only as they reached Portocheca at the end of the afternoon was it holding, icing all the roofs and gables of the steep town as a baker ices a dark plum cake.
"Oh, but look, look," cried Pierre, not calm. "The mountains, look at the snow on the roofs."
And then she fell silent. The golden lighted windows of the little town under the great slopes almost veiled in driving snow and nightfall. The welcome of the lighted windows amongst the strangeness of winter, that was too much for her. All the way down from Portocheca to the lake, she was grateful for the falling snow and darkness that hid from her the orchards, the fields, the mountains, the lake. She did not want to see them. They were not hers to see. Even as the carriage rolled onto the paved court in back of her home, even as she saw her father, bundled up till he looked more like a bolster than a man, coming to her with snow on his shoulders and his arms held out, she was saying in her heart, "Why did I come home? Why did I come home?" Then she was in her father's arms, squashed against his rough coat, the snow off his shoulder, cold on her ear.
"Are you all right, Papa? Are you well?"
"Yes, of course, I'm fine," said Count Orlant hoarsely, while the tears ran down his handsome face. He had been quite ill and was 62 this winter. It had occurred to him that he might die. He was not particularly afraid of dying, but he had been afraid of not seeing Pierre again.
"Well, well, well, what a commotion," he said, still with his arm around her,
and then the others were around them. Eleonora and Laura and Maria the cook, and Miss Elizabeth, who lived on at Valtorsa, old Givon and the rest, bandying Pierre about and bringing her inside in a flurry of welcoming faces and voices, warmth and light. Guide Sorde had not come outside and treated the excitement coolly.
"Well, Contessina, 3 months away, and you see how your value's risen?"
It was true she had been gone only 3 months, but last summer had been her next-to-last visit home. This was her last. Guide knew the difference as well as any of them. He consistently called her "you" now instead of "thou." None of them forgot that she was to be married, that she no longer belonged to them, nor they to her, that this was the last time they would see Pierre Valtorskar. When she was in her own bed, in her own room, she lay thinking, and her thoughts were as bleak as her body was comfortable. The last time. Itale had been right, of course. You can't come back. There is no coming home. She looked over at her bookshelf. There was the book he had given her, La Vita Nova, The New Life, its gold-lettered back winking comfortably in the firelight. But she did not want the new life. She wanted the old one. The next night, Christmas Eve, all the Valtorsa people but Auntie, with the Sordes and Sorrentais and many people of the estates, went into Portocheca for the midnight mass. It had snowed again during the day, clearing after sunset. Carriage lamps and lanterns crossed yellow beams over the snow. Snow on the forests of the mountainsides showed faint in starlight. The church of Portocheca was crowded from wall to wall, as always on Christmas. The little boys of the choir sang shrilly. Babies squalled. Old men sighed long, horse-like, devout sighs, and scratched their necks under their holiday white shirts. Little old women who went to Mass daily muttered the service a word or two ahead of the priest. In the hot candlelight the cross shone like molten gold above the altar. Now and then one got a dry, clean whiff of the pine boughs that decorated the church, through the smell of packed humanity, or shivered in an icy, inexplicable draught of air creeping along the stone floor amongst all the legs in skirts or trousers. It took the crowd half an hour to come out of the church, and everyone stood around in the street waiting for the rest of the party. Children got lost, horses stamped, snow dust glittered in rays and shafts of lantern light and lamplight. While the older people found the friends and relatives they had brought in or wanted to greet in town, Piera and Laura joined the young Sorrentais, who were singing the old carol of the angels. We have heard the angels sing sweetly on the mountainsides, and the echoing valleys ring with a song that well betides, Gloria in excelsis Deo. Alexander Sorrentai went flat on the glorias, and his betrothed, Maria, the daughter of Advocate Cassene, cried, "Oh, Sandra, don't sing so loud," and everybody laughed. On the way home, crammed in the Valtorskar carriage with Count Orlant, Guide, Eleonora, Cousin Betta, Emmanuel, Pernetta, and the overseer Gavre, Piera and Laura kept up their caroling until Guide himself joined in his baritone on the glorias, and Eleonora, looking up into his face as she sat squeezed next to him, said, "Guide, I haven't heard you sing in 20 years. "I have," said Laura, "when he shaves, but he always stops in the middle."
"Sing on, then," Guide said, and they all sang.
Count Orlant had lost his voice when he was ill, but he thumped time on the window frame. They all stopped at the Sorde house for the supper and Christmas cake after the mass. The cake, shaped like a log, was twined with holly and ivy. Count Orlant discoursed on holly trees, standing stones, and druids. Nobody went to bed till 5. At 11 some of them went to the morning service at St. Anthony Chapel up the lake shore. The pines above the chapel sparkled with melting snow in the wintry sunlight. On the north side of each headstone in the little churchyard snow lay white, though the graves themselves were bare. The words of the service were half lost in the sound of the wind in the forests of San Lorenz. After the service, Piera and Laura walked in the churchyard, waiting for Eleonora. They separated a little as Piera wandered on reading the inscriptions. All the stones were old. The churchyard was not used any longer. Many of them were small, unmarked. The graves of infants dead 100 years ago. All the names were familiar names. Itale Sorde, 1734-1810, In te domine speravi. She stood still. She looked at the graveyard, dappled with patches of snow and shadows of the pines, at the squat stone chapel, its eaves dripping with thawing snow, at the lake, lying calm in the winter noon, at Laura, coming towards her, tall and pale in her coat and fur-trimmed cap. They stood side by side there for a minute.
"I can remember him standing in front of the south windows. I had to reach up to hold his hand. He seemed so tall. He died the year after I was born. It's strange how when Itale and I die, there won't be anyone, Anyone in all the world who ever saw him, ever knew him. Till then, he's not really dead. But after that...
But there's an afterlife,
Fiera said timidly. Perhaps, Laura said, still looking at the grave.
You're not sure?
No. They spoke simply and thoughtfully.
It doesn't matter, does it? Laura said.
In te domine speravi. Just for it to be all over, all gone, air and earth and sun.
Would that be so bad?
But I was just thinking. Your grandfather, he was young, a young man 70 years ago, young like any young man now, like us. And then we get old. And maybe he was in love. Well, of course he was with your grandmother, and they got married, and they lived, and had 2 sons, and they thought and talked and wanted things, and there was wind and rain and sunshine on the snow, and they saw it, and now it seems so strange. And there were the people before them, and now us, and the people that come after us, and we can't know any of them because time keeps going on and on. What was my own father like when he was 20? Does he even remember himself? I have to believe in the afterlife, I think. It would be so strange and senseless without it, never to understand.
She looked around the grave streaked with sun and shadow, and her light voice shook a little.
Why were they ever young?
Gavray came round the corner of the church.
Your mother was asking for you, Miss Laura, he said, standing cap in hand by the wicket gate. Piero walked home with him and Cousin Betta. He had proved a good, reliable manager and had taken the onus of running the estate from Count Orlot, but he had never spoken to Piero more than civility required him to do. They did not speak now, but Cousin Betta did. Piera escaped from her to Count Orlant's study, where, a bit tired by the long Christmas night, he sat beside his fireplace, bedecked with garlands and cupids and a few stray French horns, carved in the same grayish native marble as the headstones in St. Anthony Churchyard. There was a bright fire on the hearth. Piera sat down next to him, and they talked. Count Orlant had discovered this past summer that he could talk to his daughter. It was very like talking with his wife in the old days. After all, she had not been much older than Piero was now. They rarely said much, but somehow it was very pleasant. In fact, it was the pleasantest thing he knew, especially now in this winter cold. He had spent some desolate hours the past month when he was ill. He foresaw and accepted his loneliness when Piero should be married and gone. But the comfort of her presence now outweighed it all. He was content. Piera herself was not content, but was happy, as she sat with her father before the fire, happier at least than she had ever been last summer. All those weeks at home had been a time of strain, suspense, toneless and colorless. She had been waiting. Waiting for what? It must be for marriage, for love. She was home, but not home for good. Betrothed, but alone. In the middle. Suspended. Waiting. It had been all wrong. She had written Givan Coste every post, a dull note once a fortnight. Writing them had been a chore, as bad as her compositions for Miss Elizabeth. The duties of the young female. If Givan loved her, why was he not there? She had left home, gone back to Esnar with relief. Had she been happy then this autumn in Esnar? Of course. But still it had been waiting. Now the waiting was over. Now time went fast, and she clung to the moments, treasured them. Everything now was for the last time. She would not think either back or ahead. 12th night came and passed, bringing snapping cold, clear weather. The roads were frozen, so the horses' hooves rang like bells. The sun was bright in a sky of dark, blazing blue. Laura and Piera rode into Portocheca for the mail, and the overseer, Gavray, having business at the mill, went with them, still saying nothing. The girls went on to the Golden Lion, leading his horse, as the Lion served as tavern, hotel, coaching station, post office, and livery stable. As they went, Piera said, "Of all the close-mouthed men in the Montaigne, that one's the closest."
"He can talk," Laura said indifferently.
I doubt it. He guards his tongue as if it were golden.
Who does talk here but us women? I suppose men jabber all the time down there. Laura often teased Piera about the sophisticated ways and customs of Esnar. It was a game between them. But just now there was a sting in her words. Piera knew she had in some way been tactless, and she said no more about Gavray. They greeted the old hostler of the Lion and gave him the horses, and after his due bit of conversation went on in and greeted the innkeeper's wife in her shining domain of oak and brass. She was ready for them, handing three letters across the bar, one for Piera, two for Laura.
"Ah," said Laura, coming alive. "Thank you, Mrs. Carl."
"Oh, aye, from Domital. I saw it this morning first thing in the sack. I know his black writin'," said Mrs. Carl, with a smugness that declared mere illiteracy no handicap. After her due bit of conversation, the girls set off for Emmanuel's house.
"Come on, Perry," Laura said. "Hurry up. I want to read it. What's this other one, I wonder? It must be for Uncle. And yours is from—" "Oh, yes," said Piera. "Itale still has the return address in Rakova on it. That's why we haven't heard from him for a month. The mails must be slow in the East. It's such a long way."
Walking at twice her usual pace and studying the cover of the letter, which she would not dishonor by opening on the street, Laura strode down the cobbled streets and steps, Piera in her wake, to Emmanuel's house. He was out. Pernetta received them, and without wasting any more time, she and Laura opened Itale's letter and read it standing, while Piera retired into a chair by the window that looked out northward through the pass, and read her letter from Givancoste. It was a quiet, fond letter, husbandly. Little Battiste enclosed a note written in a round, clear hand. "Dear Countess Piera, the preserved ginger was very good, although it was very hot, so that I ate a little at a time, but I have eaten it all. I hope you are well. Father is well. I am well. My rabbits are well. They like to eat oatmeal, as you said. With all good wishes for a happy new year, I am your loving friend, Battiste Venceslas Coste." She wanted to show the child's note to Laura, and yet did not do so. It was so queer, that is, it would seem so queer to Laura, that this child was to be Piera's child, her stepson. Here he was, 7 years old, 11 years younger than Piera, your loving friend, Battiste Venceslas Coste. Well, Laura was not used to the idea, as Piera was. No need to embarrass her.
"What does Itale have to say?"
"Read it, my dear. Now, Laura, you've read it twice. Let Piera have it. What's that, another letter?"
"Oh, yes, I forgot. Look.
For Mr. Sorde of Valmalafrena Porta Ceca, Montaigne Province. Now, who's it for, father or uncle?"
"Emmanuel will know. I must look after my baking. I'll be back."
Laura perched on the arm of the chair and reread her brother's letter as Piera read it. Rakova, 18 November, 1827.
"Look at that," said Laura. 2 months to get here. Even in winter and clear across the country, how can it take 2 months?
His first letter from Rakova only took 2 weeks.
"Now hush," said Piera, reading.
"My dear family, I'm sorry I missed last week's post, and trust that you have not given me up for lost. I have been busy ever since I arrived here, and my quiet week at Eston seems several centuries in the past. My impression of Rakova remains much the same as when I last wrote. I still dislike the city and still find it exceptionally interesting. The misery of the poor here is beyond anything I have seen. I am glad not to be alone in a place where it is very easy to become discouraged. Young Augustine has put up a pair of red curtains to cheer up our rooms and save us washing the windows. My contribution to the domestic economy has been a large box of Gossek's wonderful powder. I would not myself call it wonderful. The Prussians eat it up enthusiastically, no doubt thinking it a thoughtful gesture on the part of a stranger."
"The Prussians?" said Piera. "Cockroaches. Eva always calls them Prussians." "Oh, I thought he meant people. Let me read that over. Of a stranger.
I wish they would all die in awful agony, but I don't think they will. If my letters are delayed, please don't be alarmed. The state mail service has existed for only 3 years in the Polana. The Polana is historically disinclined to do anything the other 9 provinces are doing, and I am assured that it is as slow and as untrustworthy as any censor's heart could desire. Augustine and I will probably take the Krasnoy coach during Christmas week, and when I am back in Malenostrada, you can trust my letters to come regularly again. And what's much more, I can look forward to receiving yours. I have not heard from you since the week before I left for Eston. I am not accusing, you know, only lamenting, and feel rather as if I had made my way to the nethermost pole of the earth.
We have written him every post, Laura put in. I despise that Polana province. Why did he have to go there?
The nethermost pole of the earth. But knowing how faithful your letters are, I think with comfortable anticipation of finding a whole bundle of them when I get back to Krasnoy. I have not much to tell you beyond what I wrote in my last. Please tell me if the Bellerophon is coming. The 2 boys in charge of circulation by post are very green, and when I left Krasnoy they were in a fine muddle. If it's still not coming regularly and you are interested in it, I shall see to it myself that your copy gets on the diligence. Karantai is beginning a new story in the December number. He says, and I incline to believe him, that it will not be as good as The Young Man Leve. One can't ask for such a work as that again, so soon, even from such a man. There is no going back or doing things over, I think. My dear mother and father, my dear sister, my heart is with you now as always. My loving duty to uncle and aunt, to Count Orlant, to them all by the lake. If this letter should be the last to reach you before Christmas, may it bear my affectionate wishes for the new year and always, your loving son, Itale Sorde. As Piera read the last paragraph, her eyes began to prickle and burn. She read the words over. The moment passed.
His hand has changed a little, she said.
It's probably a bad pen.
He signs differently, less of a flourish with the S.
He doesn't sound very flourishing, Laura said wistfully. The letter doesn't really say anything at all except that he's homesick.
It doesn't say that, Piera replied firmly.
Of course it does. Oh, dear, Mama's been worried about him for weeks, and this isn't going to cheer her up. 1 page and no news. Is it because of the censors, I wonder, or because he's trying not to sound unhappy when he really is? Piera bowed her head as if rereading part of the letter.
What did he say, she asked at last. What did he write, I mean, after he was in Esnar last April?
Why, I told you, didn't I? He couldn't say much because you'd asked him not to mention your betrothal. You explained that later. I know I wrote you that he wrote that you looked very tall and very pretty. Is that what you wanted to hear again?
No, I was just thinking. It shouldn't have been me that got to see him. It should have been you or your mother. Things work out so stupidly.
So long as one of us saw him.
But it was such a stupid conversation, I never told you. We didn't know what to say. And he looked so different. Not changed, really, but completely different. A man, you know. And he was just a boy when we were all here. And he said we'd probably never meet again. That if we did, it wouldn't mean anything. It would just be like people who don't know anything about each other meeting and parting. And neither of us, he or I, would ever really go home again, and...
But her voice, which had been getting strained and faint, choked off in a sob.
This is so ridiculous, she gasped. Please, don't pay any attention, Laura. I've been doing this ever since I got home. It goes away in a minute.
Laura, at a loss, stroked her hand. Piera got control of herself very promptly and stood up to greet Emmanuel with a smile as he came in. Seeing from Laura's face rather than Piera's that something was amiss, he went on upstairs at once after 1 question. Anything from Itale?
Yes, here. The letter's weeks old. He was still in Rakova.
I'll read it in a minute. When he heard his wife talking with the girls, he judged Piera's fit was over. What would be wrong with the child? Waiting for marriage, no doubt. This fashion of long betrothals was detestable. He came downstairs. Where's dinner, women?
10 more minutes, Emmanuel. 3 women, a cook, and no dinner ready. You're nearly as inefficient as we are at the magistrature. Well, let's see what was new in Rakova 6 weeks ago.
When he had read Itale's letter, Laura showed him the second one. Which of you is it for, Uncle?
Why, for Guide, I'm not a Val Malafrena.
But then it says Portacheca.
They knew the postcoach stopped here.
But why don't you open it? If it is for you, someone would have to ride back with it. And if it's estate business, Father will consult you about it anyhow.
Practical woman, Emmanuel said. Very well.
And carefully, reluctantly, he opened the cover and began to read. Piero was watching him, curious about the letter as the others were, but she noticed nothing. It was the wife who said quietly, "What is it, Emmanuel?" He looked at her for a moment, blank-faced. "Let me finish it, my dear," he said as quietly. They waited in silence. He finished reading the letter, folded and unfolded it, sat down in the chair by the window. "It's rather bad news," he said. "Itale. He's all right. It would appear he has been arrested. They don't actually know very much."
"Read the letter,"
Pernetta said, standing still, as did Laura and Piera.
"It is intended for Guide," Emmanuel said, and then, looking up into their faces, opened the letter again and read. "Sir, I must take the liberty of introducing myself as a friend of your son, Itale Sorde, in order to ask you to have the very great kindness to write me whether you have received any word from your son since the middle of November last, or to tell me if you have any news which confirms or, God willing, disproves the report we have received here of his arrest, together with the young man who was with him, by the provincial government of the Polana in November. The first such report we received appeared unsubstantial, but we now have heard a more circumstantial report from an apparently reliable person coming to Krasnoy from Rakova, stating that both men were tried on the charge of inciting activities prejudicial to the public order, convicted and sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. If this is true, they are presumably in the St. Lazare prison in Rakova as state prisoners. We have heard nothing from Mr. Sorde since November 6th, but are now aware that mail both in and out of the East is under supervision and liable to be read and stopped or read and resealed without notice. To the best of our knowledge, the posts in the center and west are not tampered with as a general rule, but this rule may be changed, of course, at any time. As you know, your son has many friends here, all of whom earnestly desire to be of use to him and to support him against this monstrous injustice. But at this time, and until we are certain of the facts, we are following the advice of a man very familiar with the political situation of the eastern provinces, who counsels us all to wait, since an attempt at direct intervention or personal appeal could at this time do more harm than good. I beg you to write me if you have better or more certain news of him, and I pray God to uphold a just and candid man, my friend and your son, in the knowledge of his own integrity and of our steadfast affection and loyalty. I am, sir, your servant, Tomas Brelovai, Krasnoy, 2 January, 1828. Emmanuel folded the letter. His face appeared thoughtful, still a little blank. "This Brelovai sounds like an honest fellow," he said at last. "Itales mention him often, I think."
"They were in Solari together," Laura said. "He runs the journal's finances."
She spoke calmly. It was Pernetta who, shaking her clenched fists in front of her breast in a jerky, quickly repeated, strange motion, said in a loud, high voice,
I never had any son but him."
"Come, Pernetta," Emmanuel said roughly, and went and stood at the window while Laura comforted his wife. She had never broken down on him before, never once. It was as if something in his own body broke at the sound of her voice crying out, as if the strength went out of his backbone. He could not look at her. Piera came over to him and took his hand. He looked down at the girl, her pale face and clear eyes.
"If we're going out to the lake," she said, "I should go tell Gavray not to wait for Laura and me."
"That's right.
He'll still be at the mill. I'll be back in 10 minutes.
She left, moving light and fast. In the depths of his confusion and distress, Emmanuel considered her and Laura with wonder, both of them calm, efficient. Yet he knew what this news was to Laura, and as for Piera, she had been weeping about something or other not a quarter of an hour ago. They were all nerves till you came to the test, and then, by God, they were sword steel. And here were he and Pernetta no better than two blocks of wood, wringing their hands, struck dumb. He sat down and reread both letters to give himself the countenance of doing something. But the two girls did and decided everything, until the moment when he was on his own again, alone with his brother in the library of the house by the lake.
"Well, what's up, Emmanuel?"
"Itale's letter."
"That's not what brought you out in the middle of the day."
"No. It appears that a few days after he wrote that letter, he was arrested." Guide waited.
Emmanuel cleared his throat.
"It's not certain," he said. "Here's all we know."
He gave Guide Brillevi's letter and watched him read it. Guide read it through attentively. His expression did not change. At the end, he lifted his head a little and said after a pause, without expression, "What am I to do?"
"Do? How should I know? No doubt the fellow's right, and there's nothing we can do, nothing at all. But is this a time to say I told you so? Is your self-righteousness—" He stopped short. Guide was not looking at him.
"Arrested him," Guide said softly, as if trying out the words. "What right have they to judge him, to touch him?"
His face contorted into a strange frown.
"What have they done to him?" he said aloud.
He turned away and was silent.
Emmanuel sat down at the table, rubbing his hand over his forehead. He had misjudged his brother utterly. He had forgotten how ignorant Guide was, how, in this sense, innocent. Guide had been furious with Itale for debasing himself, but it had never entered his head that any human power could debase Itale. Evil to him was personal vice, greed or avarice or cruelty, envy, pride. A man fought such evil within himself and in other men, and with God's help prevailed. That injustice could be institutionalized under the name of law, that inhumanity could embody and perpetuate itself in the form of armed men and locked doors, this he knew but did not believe, had not believed until now. He did not separate himself from Itale, had never done so, even in his anger. What they did to his son, they did to him. This letter was his sentence. He was 58, and this was the first hold that human evil had taken hold on his hard, uncompromising soul. This was the first time he had ever been humiliated. He had held himself apart, kept himself clean, and now, very late, he must pay the cost of cleanness. "Guide, if this is true, which we do not know, but if it is true, then we have got to look at it squarely. It's very bad, but it could be worse. They haven't sent him to jail in Austria. They haven't given him a life sentence. 5 years. 5 years is—" Emmanuel had been a law student in Solari. He had visited the provincial prison there several times in a deliberate self-discipline. It was because he knew what prison was like that he had refused to qualify himself to be a judge, and, when offered the judgeship of the county court, had thrice declined the honor.
"One can wait 5 years," Guide said.
"Listen, Guide, I have excused myself since Itale left for having encouraged him to go. I thought it his right, his choice. I still do. But I was responsible, partly responsible. I have no excuse. I never looked to see what danger. It was my fault much more than his. He was very young."
"No matter," Guide said. "That's all past. Does Laura know about this?"
"She was there when I read the letter. She got Pernetta over the shock of it. And Piera did the same for me. They're with Eleonora now. I left it to them. They're better at this than we are, Guide."
"Aye. This is their world, their time, not mine. I've known that since he left."
Another silence. Guide sat down across the broad table from his brother.
"I used to wonder if he'd not marry Piera," Guide said. 40 years ago, there had been no question. A good match, a good pair.
They'd have married. He'd never have run off. Our father left, you know. Is it the times or the man? He came back, though. So will Itale. He sat there where you're sitting now when he told me he meant to go. I was angry. I called him a fool, and worse. For God's sake, Guide, are you going to blame yourself? Of course you were hard on him. Do you think you've ever been soft? He's not soft either. He's your son, God knows. I was not blaming myself, or Itale. The time for all that's long past. I blame the men who dared judge him. I would give my life. But he did not go on. There was no vengeance to which he could give his life, and no redress. There was nothing at all he could do.